Bigly Wizards, I think what's happening is they're getting accused of something bad, and then they try to make some change to put out the fire, you know. So, and I think what's happening for some of these companies is that they fail to understand the basics of human psychology with some of the stuff, and that there's an outrage, and then they change something in hopes that the outrage will go away, which is sort of like pouring gasoline on a fire and hoping that that will smother it.
Hello, friends, and welcome. This is the Happy Warrior Podcast, fresh takes on the most important and little-known stories of the day, hosted by the Happy Warrior Substack and everyone's favorite conservatarian journo and disabled otaku, Pete Pischke.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. This is the Happy Warrior Podcast. It's great to be here with you today. I am your host, Happy Warrior Pete, and today I have with me the wonderful and smart psychologist extraordinaire, Christopher J. Ferguson. He is an expert on several subjects, a writer for Psychology Today, a former member of the APA. You may have found his stuff writing about the connection between real-world violence and video games being not as strong or even real as you were led to believe. He's also written this excellent paper called Are Orcs Racist? Dungeons & Dragons, Ethnocentrism, Anxiety, and the Depiction of Evil Monsters. Chris is a fellow nerd, and I've interviewed him before for different projects, and he's always been excellent, so I'm really excited to have him with us here on the podcast today. Welcome, Chris. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me today. It's awesome to be here. Thanks for thinking of me.
Yeah, no, and I'm glad we got those conflict things. That's my bad. So you're an interesting character. You're definitely a nerd's nerd. You were into Dungeons & Dragons even in the 80s when it started being big, right?
Yeah, I was just kind of a young kid back then. I might have been like 11 or 12 or something like that. It had been up and running for probably a few years. But I remember starting with the red box set, you know, the basic, you know, Dungeons & Dragons. And pretty rapidly from there, got into the advanced Dungeons and Dragons, which is basically the first edition, you know, Dungeons and Dragons, and loved it. It was, you know, fantastic, you know, and pretty regularly have been gaming in the Dungeons and Dragons, you know, sort of system from that point on. I've tried a few other systems, but I seem to really like the D&D system for the most part. So yeah.
AD&D was and is too hard for me. Thaco, I could never figure that one out.
I kind of fudged the numbers after a little bit. Like, you know, as a high number, it seems pretty good.
Okay, so I bring that up because your most recent big paper, which you published last month, is you talk about the supposition about D&D being something that leads people to racism, specifically orcs, but you know, some of the other concepts in the game, like the dark elves, the drow, I mean, all kinds of silly stuff. What brought you to writing about this topic?
Well, yeah, I think kind of my course in terms of like research program has always been kind of influenced, maybe it's not a good reason, but it's always been influenced by like watching these kind of like, you know, societal panics over things and being curious about them, you know, so people will get upset about some form of media and historically it mostly came from the right. I mean, so now we're seeing more stuff coming from the left, which is sort of interesting as a cultural change, but you know, so people get upset about whether it's video games or television or, you know, eventually became like 13 Reasons Why and all that kind of stuff. And people get upset about this thing and then link it to some kind of like major social outcome that they are worried about, whether that was violence or mental illness or schizophrenia or suicide or, you know, whatever else. And oftentimes with limited data to really kind of support that linkage in their mind. And I would get kind of curious about, you know, what was the evidence base? Was there sort of this evidence to support that the sort of link existed? And if not, then what is it, you know, what is kind of like the sociology of why do we keep engaging in this cycle over and over again of moral grandstanding towards different forms of media technology? And why can we not seem to draw ourselves out of that. I mean, and there's all these interesting myths that people believe about sort of media effects, everything from people think that the movie Jaws created the problem with shark depopulation, which it didn't, or that, you know, War of the Worlds, the radio show, sent, you know, thousands of people fleeing into the woods to avoid the aliens, which it didn't, you know, and so on and so forth. So all these great narratives sort of develop about like, well, look at this really powerful form of media and what it made people do. And then you kind of look at the story carefully. And it's like, well, no, actually, that's largely an urban legend that that this sort of dramatic impact happened. But people kind of have it stuck in their head that these things are there. And then they use it to, you know, they use these stories. So when you kind of say, well, what about Dungeons and Dragons? You know, if Jaws can result in people murdering sharks by the hundreds of thousands, why can't, you know, Dungeons and Dragons cause racism? Well, part of the answer, well, Jaws didn't cause people to murder sharks by the hundreds of thousands, first off. But, you know, each of these things have to be, you know, independently evaluated. But with Dungeons and Dragons, there's been like a few murmurs here and there over the years about, you know, not even Dungeons and Dragons, but Lord of the Rings, and, you know, whether the orcs were meant to represent, you know, sort of Asian people or African people or whatever. And again, there's not much evidence to suggest that Tolkien had any such intention to do that. But in the last couple of years, there were these, like, you know, classic Twitter wars going on about this particular issue, where, you know, people adopt these, you know, very certain moral views about the harmfulness of something, either in terms of having a direct impact on some sort of bad behavior or attitude like racism, or the idea that a certain community must be shielded, you know, so they must be protected from something that is offensive to them. And those are the kind of like the real two narratives I saw really kind of emerge from this debate over orcs and drow and other evil monster races. Is one, that players playing as these, you know, or playing with, you know, in these realms where these creatures existed, that this kind of, like, you might think of it as like race essentialism, that these things are inherently evil, that people may take that and apply that to their attitudes towards real life human ethnicities. Or that there's this kind of groundswell, a consensus of players who happen to be non-white, who, you know, view these monsters as offensive and somehow traumatizing for them to experience. You know, and again, these were two assumptions that were being made, mainly based on anecdote. And I was just kind of curious about, you know, what did the data say? Did the data actually support these sorts of claims that people are making?
I love about your work, Chris, is that you so when they make claims like this, like they say, orcs, obviously Dungeons and Dragons is inherently racist because they're orcs. And, or people say, well, obviously playing Mortal Kombat in the 1990s would radicalize you into a blood cult. And the media does not, I don't think the people who say these things or the media expect anyone to actually pick it up and examine critically what they're saying. Just like, oh, yeah, of course it's common sense. No one's going to say no to this. And you're like, oh, well, actually, let me look this up. I'm going to look up the sociological history of... I enjoy that about your work. But you do make a good point. I mean, when you look at these things with a critical eye and you apply best practices, standards of evidence and reasoning into it, I mean, you can blow these things wide open. They're so ridiculous. It's hard to believe that one has to engage with this stuff, but they really do, because I think without people like you, this stuff just it just goes on and on forever. At least with you, there's a critical voice in the wilderness that's saying, hey, wait a minute, this is a little silly.
Yeah.
I bring it up when we start here about your background, because so much of this stuff seems so ridiculous to me. So I didn't grow up with D&D in the 80s. I'm not the same generation, but I can tell you that just racism, it never came up. I mean, a lot of these things, it was just not a concern. And I would say, you know, while the D&D when I was growing up was mostly a male-dominated space, is the term they like to use. I mean, race wasn't a concern. There were people of all kinds of colors and backgrounds there. It just never came up. No one cared. And then something happened between in the 90s and the 2000s when I was playing D&D with my friends, and today in 2022, what do you think happened there? How do we flip from such a dramatic, basically anyone could come and play, you know, because not all that many people are interested, and now it's like If you're going to play this game, you have to know the history of the dark seed of racism that lies within Dungeons & Dragons Edition 1. You know?
Yeah, it's just, right. Yeah.
It's too much. So how did we get here?
That's a great question. I mean, obviously, you know, Dungeons & Dragons has a history of being the focus of past moral panics. We all know this sort of Satan panic from the late 80s and early 90s, which caused Dungeons and at the time TSR, then makers of Dungeons and Dragons, to remove all the demons and devils in order to try to sort of placate sort of Christian conservatives and other religious conservatives. Yeah, so we've kind of been down this road, you know, before. I mean, I think what's happening now, I mean, the interesting thing is really two interesting things that are sort of different now about this compared to the 90s panic, although there are a lot of similarities too, of course. But, you know, one is that this seems to be coming more from the left now than the right. You know, typically it's more, historically it's been more often the right, not always, you know, and of course sometimes censorship is bipartisan too, including with video games. But oftentimes it's been sort of criticism from the right or Christian or other religious conservatives in other countries. It's not going to be Christian, of course. But and the other is it seems to be coming at least sort of from within the player base, you know, which is different from, again, the sort of Satan panic of the 90s, which mostly came from people outside the player base who didn't know much about the product. You know, so, I mean, I think what's happening is that the player base, particularly in the last 5 years or so, and even more so during the COVID epidemic, really expanded to include a more diverse group of people. And that's in many ways a great thing. I mean, it's lovely. And of course, it's good for the product. You know, obviously, the broader your customer base, the better, the more money you make in most situations. So it's a wonderful thing. But I think the sort of concern now that we're seeing with this is mirroring a lot of what's happening in other areas of our society right now. You know, so you're seeing the same sorts of, you know, there's kind of the assumption that this concept of systemic racism exists, you know, behind every bush, you know, basically that's everywhere, you know. And so we're seeing similar debates, you know, in journalism, in academia, in politics, over policing, you know. And on the left, and particularly the far left, I'm really talking about maybe like 8, you know, to 10%. Even 10% might be generous. 5 to 8%, I think, are what some, you know, analyses have concluded, that there's really that relatively small group of people that really adhere to that worldview that, you know, the United States is systemically racist and that, you know, is sort of everywhere and that every disparity can be explained in this way, and that group, who also happen to be D&D players, are now just sort of taking that worldview and applying it to Dungeons and Dragons. And so for them, yeah, they're sort of, I think probably some of them are educated in the humanities, where the sort of problematization is kind of the zeitgeist. You're trying to find something wrong with everything, you know, particularly through this colonialist, you know, race, gender, you know, sort of lens. And you're just looking for problems, yeah. And you're incentivized to look for problems. And so you see these orcs; they're inherently evil. And somehow it doesn't take a lot of imagination if you kind of come from that mindset of saying, "Well, let's make this a race thing in terms of like real life. Nobody's ever thought this before, but you know, I've had these humanities classes that have taught me to sort of look at everything through this kind of lens." So yeah, I'm kind of blaming the humanities for all this stuff. And I think there's some element of truth to that. But it's weird. I mean, it reminds, you know, people say, I look at an orc and I'm thinking this reminds me of like, you know, Asian people or African people. I don't know. But, you know, they can't even agree on which minority is representing. But, you know, and it's very selective, because if you kind of like look at the history of orcs, you know, as a concept, I mean, it really originates in Irish folklore. And then it's sort of, you know, borrowed by, you know, the British from that point, or the English from that,
yeah,
I guess that's
Tolkien's a big creation.
You know, but if you look at how they appear, they don't, I mean, you know, first edition, they look like walking pigs with European armor, you know, and even in the Lord of the Rings movies, the Peter Jackson, well, I mean, the cartoon movies from the 70s, they were gray, they were like toads. And then in even the Peter Jackson movies, their skin tone ranges from like gray to yellow to darker browns and blacks. And such. And a lot of their features look European, you know, to me. You know, they just mostly look like they're wearing kind of rusty, junky, quasi-European armor and weapons for the most part. So kind of like seeing, like looking at these representations. I actually would love to do a study to kind of do like a, you know,
the history of orcs.
Yeah. Or even just looking at how they're presented and trying to see, like, does this really represent like Asian people? the way that they're drawn or the armor they wear or the way that their feet, their facial features look or whatever else. And I'm guessing that the case is probably no, at least, you know, for what I've seen. And what people are doing is they're looking for specific examples of this particular orc happens to look more African, say, than other orcs who look more European, but they'll highlight that one and not the others. And that's creating this false correlation in their minds.
It's so crazy because it's like, it's almost like witch finding, but like, we're going to check her body, guys. We're going to find some from some skin growth somewhere. That'll be our proof. And then we're going to, yeah. And I say that jokingly, but sometimes in these communities, it can get, people can get very heated about these things. The irony, of course, is that Dungeons & Dragons is a pen and paper based game. The whole idea of D&D is you can bring whatever you want into it. You can take whatever you want. It's all up to you. It's yeah. just like, okay, so if you don't like this stuff, don't use it.
Yeah. And I see the argument used, and of course it's used in both directions. So of course, you know, the people with the, I'm going to refer to like traditionalists and progressives. So I hope, you know, neither term is disparaging necessarily. You know, we kind of look like, you know, progressives are, will make that argument, say, we're going to change Dungeons and Dragons to look this way. And if you don't like it, you can play the game however you want. But of course, that's an argument that goes in both directions. You could leave it the way it was. And then if you're progressive, you could change the game for how you play it the way you want it. So it's really not much of an argument, I think, in a way for one direction or the other.
But no, it supposes that if there are these connotations that people are taking away that's decidedly negative. A big when Wizards of the Coast agreed with this really obscure blogger about the, I think the guy's name is Quan, about the racism and what the ethnocentrism that was inherent in their Asian-based mythology D&D books, which, by the way, those are some of my favorite. And when we were playing those, it was never, you were like, oh, those Asians, they're crazy. No, it was like, this is so cool. Yeah. You know, we think all this is so neat. Why can't we have more of this? It was never looking at them in a negative light. It was looking in a very positive light. But the assumption here is with all this stuff is that these have racial connotations and people are going to think bad things about it. And that just isn't true. Even my little brother, I remember the times we would try to bring him into D&D games. He'd always want to play an orc or a half orc all the time. He thought they were wicked. He thought they were great. So yeah. I think there's so many things being assumed here that don't track in reality, at least to my eyes.
Well, I think Wizards of the Coast and Paizo as well. I hope I'm pronouncing. I can never know if I'm pronouncing Paizo correctly, but yeah. But I think these companies are they're the makers of Pathfinder for, you know, which is a similar system for your listeners who don't know what Paizo is. But I think they're facing many of the same issues that a lot of companies are now. That it's sort of, you know, they're mistaking online battles for something that means something in the real world, you know? So yeah, if you kind of look at like the stats of like Twitter users and who makes the most noise on Twitter, it ends up being like, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but some tiny, most Twitter noise is created by a tiny fraction of the US population is what it comes down to. And it's obviously, it's a very self-selected and strange, I don't mean strange in a pejorative way, but just non-representative, you know, population of individuals. And so what happens is this, you know, particularly small but incredibly vocal, very online, you know, group of individuals get upset about something or pretend to be upset about something. You know, some of it's also performative, but there's this kind of like Twitter outrage over this thing. And these companies, and it's not just role-playing companies, but these companies sort of assume that this outrage means something. You know what I mean? In other words, they need to fix the outrage. There are two real paths you can do. You can either convince yourself this is going to blow over in a week and just move on, just keep doing the stuff you're doing. Or you can get petrified and scared, particularly if you're being called racist or sexist or whatever else, and think you need to do some sort of, you know, you need to take some steps in order to mollify that, because you're assuming that if there's an outrage on Twitter, that this somehow represents what the average person wants, you know, or is upset about, or that the average player wants. Or is upset about. So you can look at the few companies that have sort of bucked this trend, like Coinbase or Trader Joe's, that have said, well, screw you, just don't buy our product. Or in the case of Coinbase, it's like, well, it's just to their own employees. Well, you don't like what we're doing? You can quit. We'll give you a generous severance package and out you go, you know? And I think, you know, only a minority of people, you know, even to some extent, you know, Netflix has kind of like skirted the edge of this a little bit, but I think, you know, with Dave Chappelle, they kind of, kind of did the same thing, not maybe as strongly as Coinbase did, but you know, and you kind of see most people don't leave, right? And most people don't drop the product or whatever. Trader Joe's just said, well, you know, because they had some products for them like Trader Jose and Trader Ming's for like Chinese and Mexican food. And if you pull most Chinese and Mexicans, they don't care, you know. So it's just like the very online, very woke, you know, liberal people that make a fuss over this. And Trader Joe's just said, well, just don't buy our product if you don't like it. And they became heroes, you know what I mean? So you can go that direction, or you can kind of go what Wizards of the Coast and Paizo have both been doing is that, you know, a blog post comes out and there's a Twitter fuss over it. And then they, in Paizo's case, they decided to remove, you know, again, there's some confusion about exactly what they're doing, but essentially decided to remove slavery as a topic from their campaign universe entirely. It was not like a good thing. It was an evil thing, you know, and you fought against it as a players. But because it was supposedly, you know, offensive to minority players, they removed it entirely.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. And Wizards of the Coast and a bunch of these companies that honestly have a pretty niche product, they've all done this now. Like Wizards of the Coast, they're big. Like they came out with their latest update, I should, for lack of a better term. And like, it just, like, the biggest changes are there, like, all the problematic language we're removing. You know, we're no longer calling them races. We're going to call them species now.
Right.
For one, it's just boring to me. It's like, okay, thanks. It's like a Microsoft Windows Office update. You're like, look, we have, you know, new Cantonese traditional style text. And I'm like, okay, I'm good for you. I don't know how that helps. I know that the people who are aggravating and agitating all the times in these communities, at least you see this in comics especially, these aren't the same people though that buy product. It turns, my experience has been the people who buy product or have the money to do so don't have a lot of time for social activism. Yeah. And for companies like DC and Marvel, and now even like more independent companies like Image, this has been catastrophic. I don't know if that'll happen with Wizards, because Wizards is a diversified enough company. They have enough products out there that I think if one wing of it goes down, they can, you know, walk it off. But I mean, at some point, something has got to give, because you even see this with Critical Role. And Critical Role probably isn't to blame, even though as much as I want to blame it, because that became popular around the same time all these new people came into playing D&D. Yeah. But even now, Critical Role is bad. Kotaku had a huge article about how horrible Critical Role is, how these are terrible white rich people. They aren't as diverse as they say. And I'm just like, all this pointless drama. I mean, I don't know about you, but I am very sick of it.
Yeah. I've never watched Critical Role, in full disclosure. I've never enjoyed watching other people play D&D.
No, me neither. I don't get it. I have watched Critical Role for, there was a gal I was dating, and that she was really into Critical Role. So I did try to engage with that, and I cannot say that sacrifice was worth it. Did not pay
any dividends. I get the impression that the dungeon wheelchair has some sort of origin with Critical Role, but I don't know if that's true or not. That's been my impression. I'm thinking of Candlekeep Mysteries, right, which had the sort of ostensibly wheelchair accessible dungeon in it. I thought I'd heard somewhere that sort of Critical Role had some place to play and sort of advocating for, you know, dungeon wheelchairs or whatever.
Yeah, no, Critical Role has a ridiculously large cast, because after it became popular, every one of the people on the Critical Role members network were like, let me in, I want to be on this thing. I'm going to be in, and they choose like some slots from like the gender and diversity, identity flag. Okay, so I'll pick disabled. And I'll pick gay, and then I'll pick, okay, and I'll be a monk or something like that. I mean, it literally was just like that. But that kind of stuff, I mean, that was rampant all over the place. I just don't know if this really helped anything. I can't say that I feel like the fandom is a better place or the game's any better. I don't know. Maybe I'm complaining too much.
You know, I try to be generous and assume there's like a good intention in there somewhere. I mean, obviously, you know, having a diverse player base in itself is a good thing. You know, it's not a bad thing. I think what happens with whether it's Critical Role or Wizards, particularly Wizards, I think what's happening is they're getting accused of something bad, and then they try to make some change to put out the fire, you know. So and I think what's happening for some of these companies is that they fail to understand the basics of human psychology with some of the stuff, and that there's an outrage, and then they change something in hopes that the outrage will go away, which is sort of like pouring gasoline on a fire and hoping that that will smother it, you know? So, I mean, because what happens is if people are motivated to engage in a particular behavior and you reward them, you get more of the behavior, not less of the behavior, which
that's what Joe Rogan's learning right now.
Which is what Joe Rogan's learning right now as well. I mean, I've never watched Joe Rogan either, in full disclosure. I try to be pretty upfront when I have not experienced something. But I think, yeah, I mean, that's exactly it, that if you sort of capitulate, sometimes you really did something wrong. So if you really did something wrong, then apologize. But if you really didn't, you know, you just sort of pissed off some people because your view is different from theirs. And if you keep capitulating, you end up what I call the apology treadmill. First off, apologies are never accepted anymore, you know, so if you apologize, that you're just, I can tick down the minutes till the next blog post comes out saying why that apology was insufficient in one way or another. And then they're just going to ask, they're just going to move the goalposts. They're going to ask for more changes and more change and more changes. And pretty soon we're adventuring in a college dorm, pretty much. You know, that's what it feels like. And the immersion's gone for a lot of us anyway. But I think that's going to be the challenge for Wizards, you know, and Paizo as they sort of face these issues is I think what you have is relatively small groups of like hardcore traditionalists who just are pissed off by any change, and progressives who just want to change it into Candlekeep Mysteries, basically, make everything Candlekeep Mysteries. And you have a relatively large group of people who are not really that engaged in the culture war, you know, element of this stuff and just want to play a good game of Dungeons and Dragons. So obviously the traditionalists are going to go and try to find some other game, perhaps. You're going to lose 10% of your audience who are hardcore traditionalists. They're going to try to find some other system that's anti-woke or whatever we're going to call it. But the question will be, is this bigger group, what are they going to put up with? You know, so how much of a change are they sort of, you know, I don't know. If they start feeling like they're adventuring in a, like I said, like a college dorm or a college library, which would be Candlekeep Mysteries, you know, then they may start to tune out of the system and look for other options that are a bit more, you know. I don't think most of us come to bubble wrap, to a bubble wrap game. That's what we want. You know, we want to be in a brutal, you know, kind of medieval world where people kind of do treat each other horribly because we're the heroes. We're the ones that are supposed to try to fix all this, you know, to some extent. And if it all looks like, you know, like I said, like, you know, some sort of progressive, highly progressive world, then it doesn't.
There's no wrongs to right.
There's no wrongs to right, basically. Yeah. I think it's wonderful, the idea of having disabled characters. If someone wants to play a disabled character in a game, by all means, as a DM, I would say go for it, you know.
Yep.
But then the question becomes is what are the challenges you face, you know, and how do you overcome those challenges within the D&D system? And I think you can by being creative. But the bad guys aren't going to like create like ramps. Their job is to keep you out of the dungeon.
The necromancer is not going to put an accessibility ramps.
Yeah,
like one of those cool doors, you know, that open when you click the post.
Yeah. So I don't think this movement is exactly about inclusivity. I mean, sometimes we don't think, right? We don't, you know, and we don't realize, oh, maybe we are doing something that's excluding this group, and maybe there's some things we can do to make them feel more welcome. And that's great. You know, so I think we should reach out and say, yeah, if you want to play a disabled character, that'd be fantastic. Yeah, I'm really psyched about that idea. That's part of the fun of the game is figuring out how to deal with that challenge within the game system, not changing the whole game universe so that it has to be like OSHA compliant or something of that sort, or you know, or whatever, or it gets to be like, you know, the I forget what the federal law is for disabilities, but you know what I mean? You know, there's a needle to be threaded somewhere between being welcoming and inclusive and just kind of making the game a caricature of itself. And I'm worried that balance isn't being struck very well right now. And I think that's because, you know, Wizards and Paizo and all the big, you know, companies are sort of listening to the progressive side because they're afraid. I don't even think it's necessarily heartfelt necessarily. They're afraid of being called racist and sexist and transphobic and, you know, and whatever else. And fair enough. I mean, I actually do believe we should be inclusive to diverse populations, but they're not listening to the traditionalists at all. And they're just assuming that, you know, if you object to any of these changes, then you are a racist.
Then obviously you're one of the bad people.
You're one of the bad guys. Yeah. And I don't think that's going to be a strategy. It's going to work.
It doesn't. I think you're right. I think you kicked onto the key issue when it goes too far, when it supposes that people were here before obviously were bad people because they didn't make enough of a stink about the problems. I think we're seeing this now with the new Lord of the Rings show that's going to come out in September of this year, Rings of Power. I've read a bunch of these articles from like The Gamer and stuff, and they kind of make that argument. They kind of like, well, if you don't like this, or you're one of those people that are like, you didn't want more diversity, well, then obviously you're one of the bad people.
Right, yeah.
You should feel ashamed. I just don't think that's, you know, especially when you're a private company.
Yeah.
You're not the government. You're not just going to get a check no matter what.
Right.
I just don't think it's helpful to antagonize the player base. So let's move this over to the other topic I want to talk to you about, and that's video games. So Chris Ferguson is pretty much, at least as far as I know, one of the preeminent scholars at looking at the violence in video games connection. All of you who are my age are probably familiar with this argument. I heard all the time growing up, even when I know I was college. This was still something. It was just generally assumed that there was this connection. I remember one time I was put into this work group during my undergrad, and the other three people were like, "We're gonna cover this topic. We're assigned it." And the other three people, they were sure there was a connection. Mm-hmm. And I was like, "I don't know. I'll be an open mind." And we just can never quite agree. I think that's true for a lot of people. Why is it? For one, because you've written so extensively on this, there's so much science that backs up. There just isn't a connection between playing a violent video game and being radicalized. In fact, as you've written, there's arguably an opposite effect that's actually leading to less violence. Why is it that despite all the good research you've done and the work that's there, how come these things never push through? Why did these myths stick around so long?
Oh, we're just waiting for the old people to die, basically. This is what it is. You know, I put that kind of flippantly, but that really is the truth. I mean, so it is the sort of what you see with moral panics is it really is very generational. And what happens is, you know, an older generation of people that aren't used to the new media or the new technology tend to be the people who are most suspicious of it. And they're the audience that the moral panic caters to because they're older, they vote, they buy newspapers, and they have money, you know. So that's why would you cater to 16-year-old kids? They have no influence whatsoever. They're not going to buy your newspaper. You know, who cares what they think? And what happens is old people die. You know, so it happened with the radio. You know, there were articles in the 40s about the dangers of the radio. You know, it happened with comic books in the 1950s and Elvis Presley. And then it happened with rock music again in the 1980s. There are all these bands. Like I just saw Alice Cooper last week. He puts on this like gory, like horror show, but it's all in good fun. You know, nobody's like takes it seriously. But you know, in the 70s when he first came out, I mean, that was like outrage that, you know, he would guillotine himself on stage and stuff like this. So the old people are used to that music. They don't worry about it. They grew up with it. You know, now it's all whatever the hell the kids are. Now it's social media and smartphones that everybody's worried about. Right. You know, so it's just each generation moves on. Some other thing that they're worried about.
So I agree. I think you're right about you're fighting human nature. But even the people who say that they're supposed to be above it, so people who are in your field, scientists, psychologists, and people in my field, journalists, it feels like you can put out as much evidence as you want, really good, strong evidence. And it just, for whatever reason, doesn't take. Maybe this has always been true. But for me, at least, it feels like on like the health issues I report on with the opioid crisis or violence in video games or even something that isn't like super scientific. Like, look, guys, when people were writing these fantasy novels of the 1940s and 50s, they were not assuming that orcs were standing for black people. You say things like that, but it's just like it doesn't click. It does. So it doesn't feel like any hard evidence, you know, like the good work that you do seems to click in, not just for normies, but for people who are supposed to be, you know, the smart ones who know better.
Yeah. Even the scholars are human. You actually see the same generational age effect with scholars. So, you know, the older scholars tend to be the ones that are more suspicious of video games than youngers. But, you know, it's also incentives. I can tell you, it's hard to get grant money saying that video games don't do anything. You know what I mean? You get a lot more grant money saying that they're going to, like, rot kids' brains. You know, that's where all the cash is. And newspaper headlines. you know, and I'm sure you know this better than I do, that first off, it's easier for a scientist to get newspaper headlines if you like scare the shit out of people. But it's also easier to, I imagine, right? It's easier to get readers if you just have a headline that scares the shit out of people.
Yeah, it's hard to get clicks when you say, actually, that thing that you're all worried about, that's nothing to worry about.
Not a thing, yeah. I mean, a classic example is like the Sandy Hook shooting in 2012 that, you know, for like 11 months, it took the investigation 11 months to file an official report that was publicly available. In that 11 months, there are all these headlines about video game violence and did he play Call of Duty and did he play like 10,000 hours on, I don't know, it was all this kind of like, you know, the typical stuff you'd expect. And the official investigation report found that he mostly played Dance Dance Revolution. And then that was it. And nobody mentioned videos again, but nobody mentioned the official investigation report pointed out he mostly played Dance Dance Revolution. So news media just kind of left it hanging. In a way, and so
that is a game that can totally radicalize you, though. There is a game that can radicalize that game at the upper levels is so frustrating. I can see the connection there. I can see the connection.
Yeah, I again, I've never actually played Dance Dance Revolution, so maybe I just don't understand how like vicious and aggressive the final. If it has boss layers or something like that, no.
It's only four arrows, but you would be surprised how competitive that game gets.
Yeah, but it is funny how like just news media just don't follow through on it, so they just don't bother to correct everything they've been saying for the last 11 months. You know, that's a little bit frustrating. I mean, I think that oddly enough, the best news for us in the video game, you know, research field was. Half the journalists suddenly decided that video games didn't cause violence once former President Trump said that it did. So there again, that's kind of a hint, too, that a lot of this stuff is we adopt our worldviews depending upon not data, but depending on who else adopts the worldview. So if you are on the left, then you adopt worldviews that are consistent with the left, and then you fly your little I believe in science flag in your front lawn. But then you just ignore all the science that doesn't support that whatever the left political worldview, you know, would say is valuable. And on the right, then you do the same thing. And so you kind of see this, if the science positions people adopt, you know, it's not that the right are wrong or the left are wrong or vice versa. It's that people adopt science positions that are consistent with their values. But on the left, we believe that global warming is a real thing. I don't know shit about global warming. So I'm just taking that on faith that the scientists who study it, you know what they're doing. And then on the right, people are less likely to believe that. But on the other hand, you know, people on the right believe that biological sex is a thing. And people on the left are less likely to endorse the sort of idea that there's an inherent dichotomy to biological sex, even though the scientific evidence says that there is, you know, so it is funny, like, you know, the more people fly these little flags of in this house, we believe in science, you know, the less I actually think they do believe in science. I think they just believe in the science they like. Science is complicated. It's not like the Bible. It's not like a set bunch of facts that are set in stone forever.
There's not a science canon.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and oftentimes there's disagreement among the scientists on a lot of things. And that's important to recognize as well. But yeah, I mean, I think it comes down to, I'm actually working on writing a book now about sort of like catastrophes, but how they all kind of like people's bad decisions can make things worse. And all that comes down to all these different biases that we have and how we interpret information. And a lot of it just comes down to, you know, we don't want our views to be challenged. So if you adopt the idea that violent video games cause aggression, and particularly if that becomes like really important to you, you know, to feel that way, like you feel like you're a righteous crusader for children by pointing this out to other people, it becomes increasingly hard for you to recognize data that may suggest that position is wrong. And if you affiliate with other people who all think the same thing, that even makes it harder. So this is what we call my side bias, you know, and you can see this with censorship right now. I mean, there's all the censorship. I think 2022 is going to be a big year for censorship, right? And you can see both sides are engaged in censorship. And they can recognize it on the other. Yeah. So, I mean, right now, like there's this, I mean, this book Mouse, right? You know, it's been pulled off a reading list in Tennessee. Yeah,
Mouse was this controversial graphic novel about the Holocaust, for those who aren't familiar.
Yeah, yeah. So, and you know, and it's being pulled from like reading lists in Tennessee. And then the left is all upset because it's mostly conservatives that are doing that. At the very same time, we have, you know, school boards on the left who are pulling to Kill a Mockingbird off of student reading. They're doing the same thing. To Kill a Mockingbird used to be considered a very progressive book about race, but now the left don't like it anymore because they think it's a white savior tale. But, you know, so it's very easy to recognize the bad behavior on your opponent's side and very difficult to recognize on your own side, which is interesting because you see people that will passionately, and again, I tend to occupy more lefty spaces, but it's very interesting to see people on the left will just condemn all these Republicans or, like, you know, banning books and, you know, yeah, I agree. That's bad. I totally agree with that. But then they're like, they'll point out, but you guys are doing it too. And I say, well, no, that doesn't count. For some reason, there's always some reason why that doesn't count. That's not real censorship. You know, it's always some other, that's like soft censorship. It's like, not a big deal.
That's for a good reason, though. So yeah. That's what you don't understand, Chris.
We're going to make it impossible for you to read this book, but that's not censorship. There's all these kind of weird treadmills. I like the one with Dr. Seuss, you know, the Dr. Seuss books that came out.
Yes, that was a thing that happened last year.
Yeah. It was all these old Dr. Seuss books that had some, like, pictures in them that, all right, yeah, I get that maybe they, you know, are outdated or whatever. They weren't, like, terrible, but they were, I mean, yeah, they were for, like, 1940s era stuff. And, you know, you could just replace the picture. You just put a new picture in. And the big debate over, like, they said, like, you know, the company that was publishing them was actually the Dr. Seuss Foundation. They decided not to publish them any longer. And they, like I said, they just could have swapped out the pictures. I thought would have been a much better solution. And everybody was saying, well, you can still buy them on eBay. You know, and as soon as people started selling them on eBay, yep, they went up to eBay and then shut it down on eBay too. So there's,
you're like, bullshit. What the heck?
You know what I mean? It's bullshit. Anytime somebody moves over to another platform, you're going to try to shut that platform too down too.
It's just eternal whack-a-mole is what it is.
Yeah, exactly. We're just going to kick Joe Rogan off of Spotify, but he can go open his own thing. But if he does, you're going to try to shut that one down, yeah, too. Come on. Don't kid us around. We know what you're up to.
We know this game. Yeah. We know what you're doing. And okay, so
bring it back to real quickly to role-playing game. They did this with TSR, right? I mean, there was briefly a resurgent TSR. I mean, I guess they still exist. But, you know, TSR, have you ever saying, like, if you don't like playing D&D the way we want to, just go do your own system. And then TSR came out. They sort of ostensibly were anti-woke or whatever. And then on Twitter, they mobbed them rather than saying, well, there you go. There's your system. You guys can play. Have fun. They're like, no, you can't play that system either. We're going to shut that down so you can't play it.
Yeah, that was, I think that would be, I don't know. I kind of think that would be a good change. But the worrisome, I think, is when we admit that we are doing this totally out of our own biases. There is that choice for Bill, like, okay. And that's a good thing. I'm kind of scared we will make the wrong choice. So let's end here, Chris. Is there something positive you're seeing in your world, the world of science or ecology, or in the culture that gives you some hope? Are there positive things happening, not just all this dark and gloom?
I think the worst moment in recent years was probably right about the time of the George Floyd murder and all the deaths, all the protests and riots that came after it. And I think, you know, at that time period, just as an individual watching it, you know, kind of doom scrolling on Twitter as all this was going down in the first weeks, it was easy to feel like, holy crap, maybe the whole world is insane. You know, and the same thing, I'm not picking on entirely on the left. I mean, you can make the same argument about the January 6th and all the kind of, like, you know, conspiracy mm-hmm. theories on the right. And just like, wow, there's a lot of really, like, I feel like maybe I'm the weird one that thinks, like, data still matters and like, the world isn't so black and white. And I think what's become obvious since then, and in a variety of different ways, is actually most people think that these extremists on the left and the right are nuts. You know, so again, like I said, I occupy a lot of left spaces. And so that feels a bit more acute to me, I think, the stuff that's going on the right, because these are people that are right around me and they can affect my job in the way that people on the right really can't. And that's not to say that pushback against some of the goofiness on the right isn't important. It is. But I'm seeing more scholars come out and challenging these sort of, like, highly woke, progressive, whatever we want to call them, ideas about whether it's about race, whether it's about policing, whether it's about media, or whatever else. And so I'm seeing this groundswell of, I know the word resistance gets overused and overhyped, but, you know, essentially pushback against some of those highly ideological views, you know, and as that's growing, and it does seem to be growing, I'm increasingly optimistic that we'll somehow move beyond this. I know other folks like John McWhorter, who I admire a lot, has been more pessimistic and kind of says like academia is dead. It's not a direct quote, but you know, I think it's kind of what he's implied. I'm a bit more optimistic than that. I actually think this, you know, this pushback needs nurturing and support. But I think, you know, it exists, and that is good to see. Yeah, there is a move towards open and transparent science and peer registration and stuff like that too, which I think has fixed a lot of our problems in psychology around data management and such. And now the big challenge is around ideology and, you know, issues around people just, you know, saying stuff that isn't true and making polarization worse. And that's why I left the APA fairly recently, because I felt that they were contributing to that. But I think I didn't get much pushback against it. You know, it seemed like most people sort of agreed, you know, at least they bothered to contact me, that the APA has really set itself on a bad course recently. So I think the ground is ripe for some fixing of the situation. It just needs leadership and it needs voice. And right now it's the, you know, it's crazy that has most attention, you know, that gets most of the media attention, I guess most pickups on social media and everything else. All we're hearing are the 8% of 5 to 8% of people on the extreme left and extreme right. You know, we think that that represents what's going on in the larger society. So we can kind of say, well, God, everybody on the right seems nuts if they think this stuff, but they don't all think that stuff. And same thing, you think everybody on the left seems nuts if they think, you know, that we're still living in an apartheid state in 1955. No, they don't think that. And we just have to figure out a way of getting the sort of center right, center left, a bit more of a voice so that they can get more control, authority, power, whatever. That all sounds really authoritarian. It's not how I mean it, but more influence, I guess, over the course of politics and journalism and science. And hopefully we can make that course correction. But no, I mean, 2 years ago, I was afraid for my job. Now I'm not. Ish. Not as bad, at least anymore. I feel a bit more free to speak publicly on a lot of these things, you know, as long as we keep it from the data and keep it respectful, I think, is the other thing, and civil. I think that is important to try to do. We're all human. You know, you can find stuff I've said that isn't civil, but we all can aspire to at least to be as respectful and civil as possible. And I think if we do that, the majority of people who want normalcy, you know, to return, I think can persevere, but I think it's going to be realistic, anywhere from a 5 to 15 year process to get us back to what felt like a normal society. I try to think of like a year that felt normal, like, you know, 2011, maybe. Yep. Something like that. This whole thing of like both sides, you know, sort of extremism on both sides were themselves decades long projects. It just didn't, wokeism didn't really erupt in 2014. It became very prevalent, very powerful in 2014, but the seeds were sown over decades of investment in academia, you know, particularly in the humanities. That's why I blame the humanities for everything. I think that, you know, that they're the root of all evil. No, I'm joking when I say that. So I think we're going to have to start, you know, that project of pushing back and trying to restore sanity, a data-based, nuanced understanding of the world, that things like race, there's a wide range of things between the U.S. being a racial utopia and being 1955 Jim Crow. You don't have to just pick one or the other. You know, we can say there still are challenges, but things are a lot better than they were for everybody decades ago. And that's okay, that we should be able to say that and recognize that. And I think, yeah, I think we'll get there. I do think we'll get there.
I hope so. I really do. And I think you're right. I think the majority of people, they are not keyed into these two super vocal groups. And I don't know if they need to be louder or the other people need to shut up, or I don't know how we're gonna I think we will figure it out in time. But yeah. I don't know how that exactly that'll play out. Well, thank you so much, Chris, for coming on. I love reading your work all the time. Really grateful you're willing to come here on the podcast. If you want to follow Professor Ferguson on Twitter, he's at CJ Ferguson 1111 on Twitter. He's a PhD psychologist. He's a professor over at Stetson University down in Florida, and he's an excellent guy. Thank you so much for coming on, Chris, and to the rest of my wonderful audience, see you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Happy Warrior Podcast. Intro and outro narrated by Nicole Carino. Music by O Wires. If you like what you hear today, please go to thehappywarrior.substack.com and subscribe. Be sure to follow us at Happy Warrior P on Twitter. Email is happywarriorp@protonmail.com.